you know, just you're seeing things the entire time, the whole way.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it was fantastic. We stopped all kinds of places along in Germany, and, you know, Amsterdam and the Netherlands were fabulous. And then Budapest was so beautiful. And we also stopped in Slovakia. And so that was a really Vienna, Austria, we stopped at.
Wow.
Went to a concert there in the big concert hall. That was really neat.
Sounds fantastic.
I better shut up so Janet can figure out when she's going to start the meeting. Hey, Janet, I was just telling everybody, if we have a meeting in October, I hope you're there. I'm not going to be able to attend that meeting.
What date is it?
Pardon me?
Oh, I think I'll be here.
Okay, good.
Still early. We've got 5 minutes.
Yes, and 7 is quorum. Yeah.
Janet?
Yes.
Yeah, hi. We have some corrections to make on the minutes for each of the meetings. So if you can make a little bit of time during the minutes for the special meeting and as well as for the regular meeting.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, Siri, what do we need for a quorum now?
7.
7? Okay.
We have 5 right now. We need 2 more participants, 2 members.
One more.
We have it.
Still 2 minutes early, so. Calling the September 1 meeting of the advisory committee to order. Would you take a roll call, please?
Will do. Chair Brennan?
Here.
Vice Chair Stroh? I can't hear you. You're on mute.
Here.
Thank you. Committee Member Rock?
Here.
Thank you. Committee Member McLooney?
Present.
Thank you. Committee Member Turley?
Here.
Thank you. Committee Member Mack?
Here.
Thank you. Committee Member Hatchett?
Here.
Thank you. Committee Member Copeland? Committee Member Smith?
Here.
Committee Member Storm? Committee Member Swint? Committee Member Andreessen? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We have quorum, Chair.
Thank you. We will receive a report on the status of AB 361. Who is presenting that?
So Rich is out of town this week. He sent you his best wishes. He's in tromping around the Trinity Alps, I believe. So I'll be here in his stead. This is what we've been doing the last couple of years. It's a reapproval of the requirement to approve a continued remote meeting as per the government's or the governor's emergency order. We're still operating under the governor's emergency order, and Monterey County is still recommending social distancing at public meetings. We've also had a pretty impactful month. Last month on staff here, we've had several staff out with COVID. So it still seems that it's hanging on there. So this is to vote to continue to have remote meetings.
Are there questions from the committee? Any comments from the public? If not, a motion is in order to continue remote meetings for the next 30 days.
I'll second the motion.
We need a maker of the motion.
Oh, in that case, I'll make the motion to continue remote meetings for at least 30 days.
And a second?
I'll second the motion.
It's been moved and seconded to continue remote meetings. Please poll the board or the committee. Siri, you're on remote.
Oh, there we go. Committee Member Turley?
Aye.
Thank you. Vice Chair Stroh?
Aye.
Committee Member Brennan? Chair Brennan?
Yes.
Thank you. Committee Member Hatchett?
Yes.
Committee Member Mack?
Yes.
Thank you. Committee Member McLooney?
Yes.
Committee Member Rock?
Yes.
Committee Member Smith?
Yes.
Committee Member Swint, have you arrived? Committee Member Andreessen? I can't hear you. We can't hear you. Okay, thank you. Committee Member Copeland, have you arrived? Committee Member Storm, have you arrived? Okay. Approved by unanimous vote.
Thank you. The next item is the accept and file actions for the advisor committee. David, you have changes?
Yes, we have one correction to make for the special meeting from the last meeting, agenda item number 3, on the first motion, we need to correct the spelling of the last name of from Stroll to Stroh. It was misspelled
Okay. Minutes. With that change, we'll accept the minutes. And are there any comments from the public? So we will adjourn this meeting and meet again in a regular session. So we're still on this Zoom site, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. The meeting is adjourned, and now I'm calling the regular meeting of the September 1 Advisory Committee meeting to order. Roll call, please.
Yes. Committee Member Turley.
Here.
Thank you. Vice Chair Stroh.
Here.
Committee Member Smith.
Here.
Committee Member Rock.
Here.
Thank you. Committee Member McLooney.
Present.
Thank you. Committee Member Mack.
Here.
Committee Member Andreessen.
Here.
Committee Member Hatchett.
Here.
Thank you. Committee Member Copeland. Committee Member Storm. Chair Brennan.
Here.
Committee Member Swint. We have quorum.
Thank you. Are there additions or changes to the agenda?
Janet, I wanted to just mention that we were unable to find somebody to present on climate action plans today. AMBAG has been the main agency that has been assisting communities with climate action plans and working with them towards qualified plans. They could not present this month. They will present at the next meeting.
Okay, thank you. Are there, now's the time for comments from the public on items not on the agenda. Are there any comments from the public?
No comments received at the district office.
Thank you. The next item is the minutes. David, do you want to?
Yes, we have a correction on agenda item number 8. Again, we want to correct the spelling of the last name of Alan Stroh from Stroll to Stroh.
Thank you. Are there any other comments? If not, we'll accept those. The summary of actions as corrected. So item 6, that is just what you announced, right?
Yeah, we'll continue that till the next meeting.
Okay, thank you. Item 7 is to receive presentation on mid-year 2022 engineering and compliance activities. Is that Amy?
Yes. Okay, good afternoon, committee members. Each year we provide a report in August of our mid-year activities. So this is kind of what's been going on between January 1st and June 30th of this year in our engineering compliance side. So first, I'll just start with a brief description of what we do over in engineering. And engineers receive permit applications. So this would be an application for an engine or a boiler, or a gas station. They review those applications and make sure that the equipment meets federal, state, and local regulatory requirements. And then they'll issue permits with conditions to make sure that they can comply with those regulations. Engineering may also develop rules and regulations. And then we also do an annual stationary source emission inventory that's submitted to the California Air Resources Board. So this first part of the year, because some of the restrictions with COVID have been lifted, we've been able to get out and do more inspections. So we've seen, you know, a practically doubling of the number of startup inspections the engineers were able to do in the first part of this year compared to last year. And we also are I'm happy to report that we hired a new engineer who started in January, So that's also helped us get through things on the engineering side. So this table kind of goes in order of how things come through engineering. So we receive permit applications. We don't have any control over that number. It's just what we get is what we get. And then the engineers issue that authority to construct. So that's their activity. And so that number is slightly higher than last year. And as I mentioned, I just talked about the startup inspections. And then once the engineer confirms that the equipment can meet all of our requirements, they'll issue the final permit to operate. And so we issued 134 of those, and that's a slight uptick from last year. We infrequently get agricultural diesel engine registrations. And then Title V permits are the federal permits that we issue for large facilities like landfills or the power plant. And we actually just issued a Title V permit for Monterey One Water, the waste treatment plant out north of Marina. And so that was the first time they've gotten a Title V permit. And then we also infrequently, but we do sometimes get emission reduction credits coming through. And that's when a source would shut down. And through a rule, they're allowed to bank those emissions in our emission reduction bank. And so we had one of those earlier this year. So once the permit's issued from engineering, it moves over to compliance. And our inspectors conduct inspections of all of the different equipment that we have permitted. And I'm happy to also report we have a new inspector starting next week. So we're very excited to have additional help. And so when those inspectors take those permits with them, they go out and make sure that the conditions are being followed. And if they find violations, they will issue a notice to the facility. We also have a team that ensures compliance with the federal asbestos regulation. And then we also respond to complaints. So on the compliance side, we also saw an increase in the number of inspections, again, because of the relaxation of people being able to go out more and do more inspections. I also wanted to mention, so notice to comply and notices of violation, I just wanted to kind of explain what that means. So a notice to comply is a notice to a facility for more of an administrative type of, it's not really a violation. So if they're supposed to be keeping records and they're not doing them exactly how they're supposed to be keeping them, then we would issue them a notice to comply, help them understand how they're supposed to be keeping those records. So next time we come out, we can see if they've made improvements. So we issue more of those types of notices to facilities. But if there really is a violation where if their permit had a limit and they can't operate more than a certain number of hours and they've gone over those hours, then we would issue them a violation. And when we issue a violation to a source, they come into our mutual settlement program. And our mutual settlement program has a matrix that we follow to determine penalties associated with those violations. And it's based on things like business size and past violations. And the base penalty is about $217. And in the past fiscal year, we received approximately $170,000 in penalties. And 80% of this was from private businesses and 20% was from government organizations. So another big piece of what happens in engineering compliance is we have a permit database. So all of those applications and inspections are entered into a database. And we had our 1 year anniversary on July 19th of using our Acela database. So that was an exciting time. And we also finished our first renewal process in the database. And so we're trying to transition to using our permit database to assess fees and issue invoices for those permit renewals instead of having our accounting department have a secondary database of information. So they are issuing those from their accounting software. So We're working on transitioning that over into Acela. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Are there any questions from the committee? If not, we'll move to the next agenda item, receive a presentation and report on daily 8-hour peak ozone concentration, et cetera. Dave Frisbee.
Yeah, I'm gonna hand this presentation over to Bill Chevalier. He's our supervising air monitoring technician. So take it away, Bill.
Okay, let me bring this up on the screen here. Can everybody see this screen and hear me okay?
Yes.
Very good. Okay. Ready? The Monterey Bay Air Resources District is responsible for the North Central Coast Air Basin, which includes Monterey, Santa Cruz, and San Benito counties. The district operates seven air... Oops. Let me bring it to the next page here. The district operates seven permanent air monitoring stations year-round to meet the regional minimum air monitoring requirements established by the Environmental Protection Agency and the California Air Resources Board. These stations are located in the San Lorenzo Valley, SLV, Santa Cruz, San Juan Bautista, Hollister, Salinas, Carmel Valley, and King City. The National Park Service operates an ozone monitor at the Pinnacles National Park to meet the EPA's visibility requirements for Class 1 airsheds. The PM2.5, or smoke, is monitored at all stations except San Juan Bautista and Pinnacles. Ozone is monitored at all stations except San Lorenzo Valley and San Juan Bautista. And PM10, also known as dust, is monitored by Hollister, or monitored only in Hollister, San Juan Bautista, and King City. Here are a couple of external views of two of our current air monitoring stations, Carmel Valley and Salinas. All of our stations are currently standalone structures. The San Juan Bautista station is a trailer that is plugged into power. In the past, we have also rented office spaces in small commercial buildings where we have set up air monitoring stations. Excuse me. Here we see the front and back sides of a gas analyzer rack found inside most of our stations. This is the inside of the Salinas station where oxides of nitrogen, carbon monoxide, and ozone are monitored. Salinas is also the only station where we monitor NOx and CO. The Partisol monitor on the right is an example of a 2.5 monitor, PM2.5 monitor, and is found on the Salinas station roof. Pollution is a byproduct of human activities and natural events, and controls are in place to try to keep pollution within acceptable limits, which are set out in the state and federal ambient air quality standards. Attainment or non-attainment status for a regulatory agency is decided on whether pollutants in that agency's jurisdiction fall within these standards each calendar year. Excuse me. The Monterey Bay Air Resources District is currently in attainment for both state and federal ozone standards, which include the 1-hour state standard. There we go. And the 8-hour state and federal standards. The district is also currently in attainment for both state and federal PM2.5 standards. The Monterey Bay Air Resource District is currently in non-attainment for the state PM10 standards. This graph shows a typical annual cycle of exceedances in the spring and summer, which are caused by wind-driven dust up the Salinas Valley. There is also a spike in Hollister PM10 in early June, which came from a large-scale housing development adjacent to the air monitoring station. Here's a picture of a clarity sensor, which is a low-cost PM sensor, which has its own battery and solar panel and a cellular connection. These sensors can be put up anywhere there is cellular service and can be set up and put in service in minutes. The district has put together a smoke monitoring network of about 25 sensors so far in order to have more extensive coverage, more rapid response to fire incidents than our 7-station regulatory network can provide. This allows us to see the impacts of fire in areas that might not be seen by the regulatory network. One example that we see here is a controlled burn in the Salinas Valley. Soledad, because of its location against the side of the Salinas Valley, is often impacted by smoke plumes that travel along the edge of the hills behind the city. Because many of these fires are relatively small, they are not picked up by our monitoring stations in Salinas and King City. A few weeks ago, there was a small fire near the De La Viega golf course in Santa Cruz, which was picked up by the clarity sensor in Scotts Valley. And these are a few examples of what the sensor network can pick up that we don't often see with our regular network. That is all I have right now. Is there any questions?
Are there questions from the committee members?
Yeah.
Eric?
Are there any holes in the clarity sensor network that we'd like to plug, or in any ways we'd like to develop that more?
We've got monitors in most of the populated areas in our district. At some point, we might possibly try to look at some of the small towns, such as, Davenport up north. Right now, all the areas that we typically see fires in or that normally don't get coverage now have a clarity sensor, but we are keeping our eyes open for other places we might want to put a sensor in the future.
That makes sense.
And other questions? Oh, Eric.
Do you mind if I ask another?
Yeah.
How is that data stored or processed or, yeah.
Okay, so the clarity sensor, are you talking about the clarity sensors or the regular ambient network?
The clarity.
Clarity sensors. So there is, they're stored online. They're stored online by Clarity, company that makes these sensors. We have access to that data. We have our own, a control panel allows us to get into the sensors. We can download the data. We can print it out. We can also make graphs of the data as well. So we can so you see that map, which is like the current air quality, but we can also look at historical air quality for those areas as well.
Awesome. Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, we will go to item 9, receive an update on the air toxics program. Is that Amy?
Yep, me again. Okay, hello again. I'm going to give you an update on our air toxics program, and I've got Song here as well. He's the main person who's working on this program, and we really appreciate his help. Just for perspective, we have over 1,000 facilities to review, and in order to make this manageable, we've kind of broken it off into smaller chunks. So we've started out with about 100 to initially review. So I'm just going to describe what is an air toxics, what is the Air Toxics Hotspots Act, and then how this is implemented here at the district. So there, of course, are two definitions for an air toxic. The United States Environmental Protection Agency calls them a hazardous air pollutant, or a HAP, and those are specifically identified in the Clean Air Act. And then the California Air Resources Board at the state level calls them toxic air contaminants, and it includes the federal hazardous air pollutant list in addition to hundreds of more chemicals that the California Air Resources Board has identified as toxic. So the hotspots program came about because there was a bill passed in 1987, and we call it AB 2588. And the goals of the act were to collect emissions information for toxics, identify facilities having localized impacts, determine health risk, and notify affected individuals. So there are five steps in the process when you put a facility through review. And so the first step is to determine applicability. And that's based on the annual level of emissions and the source classification. And that means if it's an engine or an auto body shop, gas station. And then these facilities prepare emission inventory plans and reports. And they need to identify all of the sources of air emissions at their facility and estimate the emissions of those toxic air contaminants from those sources. And they submit that information to us. And then this can lead to risk assessment, public notification, and possibly risk reduction. So I'll talk a little bit more about those things. So as I mentioned, we get the emission inventory from the facility and we take that information and we follow a methodology that's established and we evaluate the risk to do what is called a prioritization score. And that's calculated by SONG, and it's based on the emission inventory data and established health values for each of the individual toxic air contaminants that are reported. And each facility is scored based on three different risk categories, and that's cancer, acute, and chronic. And so if the prioritization score is greater than 10, then the facility is required to submit a health risk assessment. And the prioritization score is a very conservative estimate of risk. So if it ends up being greater than 10, the health risk assessment is more, it's a finer review and more specific to that source where they're located. You use meteorological data to really understand whether the risk, if a health risk assessment shows the risk still remains high. If the prioritization score is between 1 and 10, then that's an intermediate facility, and they have to submit an inventory update to us every 4 years. And then if you're scored low, then you're exempt from needing to do anything further. And we found that the majority of our facilities that we've reviewed have fallen into the intermediate or low categories. So if a facility does a health risk assessment, and that shows that they are still greater than 10 in a million. These are the, the table here shows the thresholds for those three types of risk I mentioned, cancer, chronic, and acute. So when the facility does that risk assessment, oftentimes they'll have a consultant do it. And if they're above the values in this table, then that triggers them needing to do a public notification. And Rich always likes to call this the public shaming rule. Because basically, if your emissions are creating a risk, you have to notify those individuals around your facility of the risk. And then with that, you also then have to create a risk reduction plan. And that is the point of that is to figure out how are you going to reduce that risk so you're no longer over that prioritization score of 10. And so it may be that they need to buy newer equipment that meets lower emission limits, change diesel fuel to some other type of fuel. So the facility needs to put together a plan of how they're going to reduce the risk, and they submit that plan to us, and they get 5 years to implement their plan to reduce risk. So there's been a lot of activity going on here and at the state. So when a facility has to do a health risk assessment, we then have to forward that on to OEHA, which is the Office of Environmental Health and Hazard Assessment. and they review those health risk assessments just to make sure that they agree with us on the results. And so this year we had two hospitals that moved from a high risk to intermediate based on their health risk assessment, but we do have one hospital that remains high risk. And so they've moved into that public notification risk reduction planning mode. And then the first quarter of this year, the California Air Resources Board has been doing a lot of regulatory work on their side, which directly is parallel to this effort of doing AB 2588. So they have a regulation that requires annual reporting of criteria and toxic air contaminants. And so for many of our facilities, this means although they were identified as intermediate and under AB 2588 only have to do an emission inventory every 4 years, because of this new regulation, a lot of those facilities in a couple of years are going to be transferred over to annual reporting so that they meet this new regulation's requirements. And then in February, the Air Resources Board approved the gasoline service station industry-wide risk assessment guidance document. And so this helps us, we're gonna start looking at gas station risk and following this methodology that the California Air Resources Board established. And then finally, in March, to kind of marry up with the criteria and toxics reporting regulation, the California Air Resources Board updated their hotspots guidelines to include the hundreds of additional substances that were included in that regulation that was adopted in January. So for us here, we're going to complete the source categories that we've been working on. As I mentioned, we're going to start following the new guidance for evaluating risk from gas stations. And then, as I said, we're going to transition those intermediate facilities into annual reporting as required by CARB's reporting regulation. So with that, I'll take questions.
Questions. I have a couple of questions. The district was the first one in the state to adopt a toxic air contaminant rule, Rule 1000. What is the status of that rule?
So we updated that rule, hang on, it's in my report, 2017 maybe, 2018, because we...
2017.
Thanks, Song. Because OEHA updated their risk guidelines, so we updated the rule to be consistent with OEHA's newly released guidance, so it's now consistent.
So the state pretty much took care of that issue. What is the status of diesel exhaust as a toxic air contaminant?
It's a cancer risk.
Yeah, currently OEHA still hasn't developed a chronic or an acute hazard index. It's still a cancer risk. So it's all the diesel exhaust particulate matter put in together, and they developed the cancer risk value for that. So all the diesel volatile organics is all combined into one from the diesel exhaust PM.
Okay. In terms of CEQA review under the California Environmental Quality Act, does the district look at toxic air contaminants in the projects?
We do look at that. We look at the we comment on the construction emissions. If there is a tier three or tier four engines, there's really no use for doing a health risk assessment on those projects. But beyond that, we don't do anything further.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other?
Jan, I will say, I think we did also, I think Song helped with this. The Costco gas station, we did have some comments about that as it relates to risk.
Okay, thank you. Lacey, you have your hand up?
Yeah, I have a question, and you'll have to excuse me. I'm trying to translate a lot of this just into what it actually means, sort of tangibly. So you mentioned gas stations and hospitals, but are all of the, is all of the pollution then still related to diesel? Like, is it hospital generators or is it coming from other locations as well? And then my follow-up question is regarding notification. So if there is something that's deemed to be excessively high, what sort of notification is given beyond, you know, sort of the traditional Prop 65 cancer risk warnings that we see and don't pay much attention to?
So this hotspots review is a review of all of the sources at a facility. So it could be natural gas boilers, diesel engines, if they had some kind of a fume hood that they use chemicals in. So you're looking at everything at that facility. And normally what we do, what Janet had mentioned, Rule 1000, we do a Rule 1000 review on an individual permit and determine whether or not that individual engine might have a certain risk. But really this program expands it. So we're looking at everything from a facility at the same time and saying, what does that risk look like? And so it's not just diesel, it's any wide variety that the list, like I said, there's hundreds of compounds and sources that contribute toxics. And so we want to look at everything at the facility. And then the public notification, the facility, I think, has to send it, Song, to people within a certain.
So when the facility does their health risk assessment and when they do the modeling and they extract that risk, they have the ability to create like what we call isoplefs. So basically it's like zones. So they can create, oh, which zone has a risk that is greater than 10 in a million, which is that significant risk threshold that Amy was talking about, which zone has, you know, less than one and things like that. So once the facility can extract that and put it on a map and has that zone of that 10 greater, anything greater than 10, then they will try to notify all the neighbors or the residents in that significant risk threshold zone and then notify the public. And then we can also put it on our website to, that's an additional resource to inform other public as well.
Other comments?
Thank you.
I have a question related to the synergistic effect of various toxics. Is there any attempt to address synergism?
At this time, there's not. We just look at each individual chemical's health risk value and evaluate it based on that.
Okay. So if there are no other questions or comments, we'll go to receive the monthly oral report from the Air Pollution Control Officer, David.
Okay, so Rich isn't here today, so I'm taking his place. We'll start off with, we had a request from one of the committee members to receive any of the color, anything that needs color, like charts or graphs, to be printed and reported out to you in color. So we're going to attempt to do that in future agenda items and agenda packets. For the previous board meeting, they received on August 17th, they received the same reports you did today on the air monitoring update and the engineering and compliance update. The board also heard the adjustment to their schedule, the meeting schedule. So now the board's gonna be meeting every other month during the year. There's just not that many agenda items that we've had in past years. So they felt that going to every other month would be much more efficient. So there's no meeting in January or July. And the other months that there aren't meetings, that will just be reserved just in case we need to, for example, hear about or make a decision on a grant, receiving grants and going entering into grants. So moving on, we've had a significant number of staff come down with COVID the last month, as I mentioned earlier. We've been following our own COVID-19 plan, which is based on local, state, and federal requirements. As far as we have a recruitment underway for two air quality planners. We had interviews yesterday and we've had some promising applicants. So we're hopeful that we'll get a couple of planners on board soon because we've been way understaffed for several months now. Last month, we had our first hearing board meeting of the year. Hearing board presides over variance requests, which may allow the facility that is out of compliance to continue operating while completing an approved action plan. We still have two vacant member positions for this board. We've received a couple of applications and we're gonna take those applications to the board for approval in October. Last month, we received several odor complaints regarding a industrial wastewater treatment pond in Hollister. The pond receives water from a tomato processing plant. We're currently investigating the odor complaints. We do have had for many years nuisance violations off and on over the years. The ponds tend to go septic and turn over and it causes quite an odor in the town. So working with them on that and trying to resolve those issues. We had two odor complaints in Marina, one on June 22nd and July 28th. Based on the information received, normal operations were going on at the landfill and wastewater treatment plant on both days. So still investigating that. It's our understanding that the city of Marina has selected a consultant, SCS Engineering, for their odor attribution study. So hopefully we'll get some more better understanding on what the odors are caused by. We've received complaints regarding a construction project near the high school in Santa Cruz High. It's a lead abatement project, which is not ordinarily regulated by MBARD. We did not receive an asbestos notification, although there was some asbestos found in that project. It's not regulated. It's not regulated levels. There were some asbestos cement pipe that was found nearby. It was stored on a street near the high school, and we had neighbors complaining about it. It wasn't at regulatory levels and it was removed on August 3rd. So that was taken care of. We still receive some complaint calls about the project, but currently the site is not subject to district regulations. So there's really nothing we can do further on it. The governor yesterday issued a proclamation, a state of emergency concerning the heat wave that's coming. The proclamation allows permitted and unpermitted equipment to operate, specifically engines, standby generator sets. They have limited amount of time and under certain situations they can only operate, but because of the heat wave, they need to get as much energy into the grid as possible. So they can allow the use of these engines. That will be in effect until through Wednesday. In planning and air monitoring, we just hired a new air quality technician. Actually, that position is going to be shared between planning, air monitoring, and compliance. Her name's Kara Hall. She's has a BS in public affairs with major environmental management from Indiana University. She's got extensive experience in public outreach and natural resources. She's worked in various places of Monterey Bay Aquarium, Monterey Bay Whale Watch, and Point Lobos. So she's a welcome addition to our staff. Air monitoring staff are installing more of the clarity sensors that you saw Bill talk about earlier. We're going to get up to 30 sensors in the region. We've focused on installing a sensor in each of the incorporated areas in the district. And more densely populated areas in the unincorporated parts of the district within the counties. So we are focusing on dense population areas. Almost all of those sensors have been installed at elementary schools and high schools in the region. We recently, planning staff, recently met with the County of Monterey Office of Emergency Services and Breathe California to discuss the potential deployment of portable air filters for the development of clean air centers. These clean air centers are going to be established during wildfire events for people to try to escape high concentrations of smoke that could potentially be impacting their area. This should help people that will have a difficult time leaving the area if they, to escape smoke. So this is a new approach that we're gonna try. We're looking at getting a grant from the Air Resources Board to purchase these portable air filters. We're going to start with about 20 air filters, and we're working with the county offices of emergency services to help designate cleaner air centers for when that happens. The district's electric bicycle incentive program, which provides $500 to purchase an electric bicycle with an additional $500 for low-income applicants, has run out of funding. We ran out within a month after the beginning of the fiscal year when the program started. We had $50,000 budgeted for the program. We had 37 of the 64 recipients as low income. So we had a lot of interest from low income applicants, and we just blew through the funding. So got a lot of bikes out there now, 64 of them. And then we had just completed the prior year's program. So that's about $100,000 for the last 2 years towards electric bicycles.
Can I ask a quick question on that?
Sure.
Do we track sort of where they all went by community? You know, so do we know that they went to Hollister or Monterey or Seaside or?
We do track the locations of addresses of all the applicants. We have all that information. So if we could compile that. If you're interested, we can try to bring that to the next advisory committee meeting.
I'd be curious, to see how much of an impact it might have.
We'll bring some stats to you. We do a little survey along with the applications. And so we'll put something together for you for next time.
Thanks.
Okay. Monterey Bay Electric Vehicle Incentive Program, which provides an incentive to purchase new and used all electric or plug-in electric vehicles, is continuing. We haven't had quite the success this year. It's gotten a lot stricter as far as we base our program on the California Vehicle Rebate Project requirements, and eligibility has gone is limited the number of and brands of vehicles that can be eligible for the program. So for example, Teslas are no longer eligible. So it's slowed down the program. Any vehicle over $60,000 is not eligible for the program either. So it had within limits. So there's a lot more limited options for people. We've gone through in the first month, month and a half, $94,000 has been obligated, and seven of the applicants, we've had 45 applications and seven of them are low income. We've got about $256,000 remaining in the program. So we have, we're working with Ecology Action in Santa Cruz to put on a National Drive Electric Day. It's going to be in Salinas at the train depot at the new extension parking lot right next to Amtrak station. Expect to have about 300 to 500 attendees. Dealers will be bringing cars to test drive. Electric vehicle owners will be there to display their bikes, their motorcycles, and their cars. will be a fun educational activities and events and kids games. So it should be a good event. Last year was a lot of fun. So if you're interested, come on out. You can test drive an electric car. And they are, if you haven't driven one before, the performance is pretty amazing. So I highly recommend it. Lastly, we've got California Clean Air Day on October 5th. It's a unified day of action where Californians can create new habits to clear the air for all members of California's diverse communities. So you can get online and make the Clean Air Pledge. And we have a link on our webpage if you're interested in checking that out. And with that, that is the end of report. Thank you.
Are there questions?
Yeah, I had a couple of questions. One is, since the board has kind of reconfigured their meeting dates, is that going to travel down to our committee? I know we just cancel meetings, but it's kind of, you know, we never know when or what. And we also do not meet in January and July. But if it's more efficient for the board to meet, you know, every 2 months, then I was kind of wondering if it wouldn't be more efficient for our committee, when you brought that up, just off the top of my head, if we took a look at our meeting schedule at some point in the future.
Yeah, I think that's something that could be looked at. I'll bring that up with Rich, and I think the chair could have that on our agenda for next meeting.
Okay.
So I'll work with Rich on that.
And just one other thing, could you repeat the dates of that get together at the train station?
That's on Sunday, October 2nd from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. So we'll have a table there and be talking about our electric vehicle incentive program.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, David. Any suggestions for future agenda items? We have one from Alan. Anything else? I have no comments. Comments from committee members? Any comments from the public? All right. Seeing no additional items, I'll adjourn the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you.